Blog Talk Radio.
Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Greetings and love to one and all. This message is brought to you by Mr. Anderson, and I'm Mr. Anderson. I'm here to tell you about iGrowYouGrow.biz. That's iGrowUGROW.biz, where we empower you to produce your produce. Is this the year that you eat what you grow? Is this the year that you get that garden right? I say yes. Please visit iGrowUGROW.biz, where we will give you instructional media and inspiration to get you growing. Everything from composting to transplanting to seed starting to natural pest control with household items that you probably already have. These things will be yours to have if you join the I Grow, You Grow movement. You have nothing to lose and everything to gain. Get that garden right this year with iGrowYouGrow.biz. Thank you for tuning in to CREE. Fare ye well.
Greetings. This is the Counter Racist Evolving Engineer Program. The acronym for the program is CREE, CREE, and that is my handle. The date is Thursday, July 12th, 2012. I'm waiting for my Counter Racist Funk Band to show up. Had a good one last Thursday. Wouldn't like this to be sort of a repeat of what happened on Tuesday, in which, unfortunately, the guest that I had thought would be joining me was unable to, and that was Dr. John Carlos, the bronze medalist at the 1968 Olympics for the 200 meters, who was part of the most famous image in sports history. And that would be the glove fist. And so I have been in contact with his agent from that night on, but we still haven't nailed down a dirt date certain to for the reschedule. So I was thinking for sure that LBM would be joining me today, and I was hoping possibly that Sister from Chicago or other callers would be joining me. I'm not doing any solo riffs this evening. So what I will do is just talk about my general disgust with the continued cover-up and deceit that we should expect from white folk. This latest report that came out today by this special inquiry, I have yet to read it. I did download the PDF that was done by a team that was headed by the former FBI director, Louis Free, went and said, you know, that basically, from what I understand, the gist of it is that there was a cover-up. He didn't say that there were other people involved in a child porn sex ring. What he said was that the legendary Joe Paterno and the administrators of the legendary football program there at Penn State were to blame for a cover-up, because the way that we're supposed to hear this is that they were too concerned about the reputation of the football program, the university, and the dollars that come with that, and that therefore they willfully participated in a conspiracy to cover up criminal activity that was abominable, and the rape of young boys, most of whom were black. Well, as far as I'm concerned, that's more cover-up. It's quite clear to me that there's more going on simply than just covering up for the name and the financial health of the university and the football program. But that's just to keep us from understanding how widespread and how normative this behavior is, and how predatorial white folk are. Okay. So that's to be expected, and I know that sounds way far out there for a lot of people. So I will say that, and I have not much more to say. I would need other people to join me in the conversation to continue where we left off last Thursday, and we have nobody on the switchboard. So I might play a little bit of music, and then if no one joins me, I will close out and I will delete this non-program. So if you would like to continue the conversation that we had last Thursday, which is just picking up where we left off, discussing the functional value and definition of erotic quote-unquote love, which we, you know, had a lot of discussion as to whether or not that should be used and why it shouldn't and why people are reluctant to use that. When we're talking about a relationship between black male and black female under this construct of global white domination. And, of course, the conversation is free-ranging, so we never know where that's going to go. So I'll play a little music. If no one has shown up on my switchboard by then, I'll close out and delete. Let's see here. What's on the switchboard?
Don't you know that haste goes around, brings evil plans to make you its possession. And it will, if we let it, destroy everybody. We all must take precautionary measures. If love and peace you treasure, then you hear me when I say, don't you know that love and need, oh, love today. Don't delay till yours and send it here right away. Oh, cause I know hate's going around, breaking many hearts. Oh, you better stop it, please. Far. Oh, I know that love's
Can't you take my hand? Make me know the way. You'll find all these things that you see.
TED Talks are recorded live at the TED Conference. This episode features the sociologist and expert on romantic love, Helen Fisher. Here's Helen Fisher.
I and my colleagues Art Aaron and Lucy Brown and others have put 37 people who are madly in love into a functional MRI brain scanner. 17 who are happily in love, 15 who had just been dumped, and we're just starting our third experiment, studying people who report that they're still in love after 10 to 25 years of marriage. So this is the short story of that research. In the jungles of Guatemala in Tikal stands a temple. It was built by the grandest sun king of the grandest city-state, of the grandest civilization of the Americas, the Mayas. His name was Kasakantawi. He stood over 6 feet tall. He lived into his 80s, and he was buried beneath this monument in 720 AD. And Mayan inscriptions proclaim that he was deeply in love with his wife, so he built a temple in her honor facing his. And every spring and autumn, exactly at the equinox, the sun rises behind his temple and perfectly bathes her temple with his shadow. And as the sun sets behind her temple in the afternoon, it perfectly bathes his temple with her shadow. After 1,300 years, these two lovers still touch and kiss from their tomb. Around the world, people love. They sing for love. They dance for love. They compose poems and stories about love. They tell myths and legends about love. They pine for love. They live for love. They kill for love. And they die for love. As Walt Whitman once said, he said, "Oh, I would stake all for you." Anthropologists have found evidence of romantic love in 170 societies. They've never found a society that did not have it. But love isn't always a happy experience. In one study of college students, they asked a lot of questions about love, but the two that stood out to me the most were, "Have you ever been rejected by somebody who you really loved?" And the second question was, "Have you ever dumped somebody who really loved you?" And almost 95% of both men and women said yes to both. Almost nobody gets out of love alive. So before I start telling you about the brain, I want to read for you what I think is the most powerful love poem on earth. There's other love poems that are, of course, just as good, but I don't think this one can be surpassed. It was told by an anonymous Kwakiutl Indian of southern Alaska to a missionary in 1896. Here it is. I've never had the opportunity to say it before. "Fire runs through my body with the pain of loving you. Pain runs through my body with the fires of my love for you. Pain like a boil about to burst with my love for you. Consumed by fire with my love for you. I remember what you said to me. I am thinking of your love for me. I am torn by your love for me. Pain and more pain. Where are you going with my love? I'm told you will go from here. I'm told you will leave me here. My body is numb with grief. Remember what I said, my love. Goodbye, my love, goodbye. Emily Dickinson once wrote, "Parting is all we need to know of hell." How many people have suffered in all the millions of years of human evolution? How many people around the world are dancing with elation at this very minute? Romantic love is one of the most powerful sensations on earth. So several years ago, I decided to look into the brain and study this madness. Our first study of people who are happily loved has been widely publicized, so I'm only going to say a very little bit about it. We found activity in a tiny little factory near the base of the brain called the ventral tegmental area. We found activity in some cells called the A10 cells, cells that actually make dopamine, a natural stimulant, and spray it to many brain regions. Indeed, this part, the VTA, is part of the brain's reward system. It's way below your cognitive thinking process. It's below your emotions. It's part of what we call the reptilian core of the brain, associated with wanting, with motivation, with focus, and with craving. In fact, the same brain region where we found activity becomes active also when you feel the rush of cocaine. But romantic love is much more than a cocaine high, if you come down from cocaine. Romantic love is an obsession. It possesses you. You lose your sense of self. You can't stop thinking about another human being. Somebody is camping in your head. As an 8th century Japanese poet said, "My longing had no time when it ceases." Wild is love. And the obsession can get worse when you've been rejected. So right now, Lucy Brown and I, the neuroscientist on our project, are looking at the data of the people who we put into the machine after they had just been dumped. It was very difficult, actually, putting these people in the machine because they were in such bad shape. So anyway, we found activity in three brain regions. We found activity in a brain region, in exactly the same brain region associated with intense romantic love. What a bad deal. You know, when you've been dumped, the one thing you love to do is just forget about this human being and then go on with your life. But no, you just love them harder. As the poet Terence, the Roman poet, once said, he said, "The less my hope, the hotter my love." And indeed, we now know why. 2,000 years later, we can explain this in the brain. That brain system, the reward system for wanting, for motivation, for craving, for focus, becomes more active when you can't get what you want. In this case, life's greatest prize, an appropriate mating partner. We found activity in other brain regions also, in a brain region associated with calculating gains and losses. You know, you're lying there, you're looking at the picture, you're calculating, you know, what went wrong? What have I lost? As a matter of fact, Lucy and I have a little joke about this. It comes from a David Mamet play, and there's two con artists in the play, and the woman is conning the man, and the man looks at the woman and says, "Oh, you're a bad pony. I'm not going to bet on you." And indeed, it's this part of the brain, the core of the nucleus accumbens, actually, that's becoming active as you're measuring your gains and losses. It's also the brain region that becomes active when you're willing to take enormous risks for huge gains and huge losses. Last but not least, we found activity in the brain region associated with deep attachment to another individual. No wonder people suffer around the world, and we have so many crimes of passion. When you've been rejected in love, not only are you engulfed with feelings of romantic love, but you're feeling deep attachment to this individual. Moreover, this brain circuit for reward is working, and you're feeling intense energy, intense focus, intense motivation, and the willingness to risk it all to win life's greatest prize. So what have I learned from this experiment that I would like to tell the world? Foremost, I've come to think that romantic love is a drive, a basic mating drive, not the sex drive. The sex drive gets you out there looking for a whole range of partners. Romantic love enables you to focus your mating energy on just one at a time, conserve your mating energy, and start the mating process with a single individual. I think of all the poetry that I've read about romantic love, what sums it up best is something that is said by Plato over 2,000 years ago. He said, "The god of love lives in the state of need." It is a need. It is an urge. It is a homeostatic imbalance, like hunger and thirst. It's almost impossible to stamp out. I've also come to believe that romantic love is an addiction, a perfectly wonderful addiction when it's going well, and a perfectly horrible addiction when it's going poorly. And indeed, it has all of the characteristics of an addiction. You focus on the person, you obsessively think about them, you crave them. And it's got the three main characteristics of addiction: tolerance, you need to see them more and more and more, withdrawals, and last, relapse. I've got a girlfriend who's just getting over a terrible love affair. It's been about 8 months. She's beginning to feel better. And she was driving along in her car the other day, and suddenly she heard a song on the car radio that reminded her of this man. And she, not only did the instant craving come back, but she had to pull over the road from the side of the road and cry. So one thing I would like the medical and the legal community and even the college community to see if they can understand that indeed romantic love is one of the most addictive substances on earth. I would also like to tell the world that animals love. There's not an animal on this planet that'll copulate with anything that comes along. Too old, too young, too scruffy, too stupid, and they won't do it. Unless you're stuck in a laboratory cage, if you spend your entire life in a little box, you're not going to be as picky about who you have sex with. But I've looked in 100 species, and everywhere in the wild, animals have favorites. As a matter of fact, ethologists know this. There's over eight words for what they call animal favoritism: selective proceptivity, mate choice, female choice, sexual choice. And indeed, there are now 3 academic articles in which they've looked at this attraction, which may only last for a second, but it's a definite attraction, and it's either the same brain region, this reward system, or the chemicals of that reward system are involved. In fact, I think animal attraction can be instant. You can see an elephant instantly go for another elephant, and I think that this is really the origins of what you and I call love at first sight. People have often asked me whether what I know about love has spoiled it for me. I just simply say, hardly. You can know every single ingredient in a piece of chocolate cake, and then when you sit down and eat that cake, you can still feel that joy. And certainly I make all the same mistakes everybody else does too. But it's really deepened my understanding and compassion, really, for all human life. As a matter of fact, in New York, I often catch myself looking in baby carriages and feeling a little sorry for the tot. And in fact, sometimes I feel a little sorry for the chicken on my dinner plate when I think of how intense this brain system is. Our newest experiment has been hatched by my colleague Art Aaron, putting people who are reporting that they are still in love in a long-term relationship into the functional MRI. We put 5 people in so far, and indeed we found exactly the same thing. They're not lying. The brain areas associated with intense romantic love still become active 25 years later. There are still many questions to be answered and asked about romantic love. The question that I'm working on right this minute, and I'm only going to say it for a second and then end, is why do you fall in love with one person rather than another? The reason I never would have even thought to think of this, but Match.com, the internet dating site, came to me 3 years ago and asked me that question. And I said, I don't know. I know what happens in the brain when you do become in love, but I don't know why you fall in love with one person rather than another. And so I've spent the last 3 years on this. And there's many reasons that you fall in love with one person rather than another that psychologists can tell you. We tend to fall in love with somebody from the same socioeconomic background, the same general level of intelligence, the same general level of good looks, the same religious values. Your childhood certainly plays a role, but nobody knows how. And that's about it. That's all they know. No, they've never found the way two personalities fit together to make a good relationship. So it began to occur to me that maybe your biology pulls you towards some people rather than another. And I have concocted a questionnaire to see to what degree you express dopamine, serotonin, estrogen, and testosterone. I think we've evolved 4 very broad personality types associated with the ratios of these 4 chemicals in the brain. And on this dating site that I've created called chemistry.com, I ask you first a series of questions to see to what degree you express these chemicals, and I'm watching who chooses who to love. And 3.7 million people have taken the questionnaire in America. About 600,000 people have taken it in 33 other countries. I'm putting the data together now, and at some point, there will always be magic to love, but I think I will come closer to understanding why it is you can walk into a room and everybody is from your background, your same general level of intelligence, your same general level of good looks, and you don't feel pulled towards all of them. I think there's biology to that. I think we're going to end up in the next few years to understand all kinds of brain mechanisms that pull us to one person rather than another. So I will close with this. Love is in us. It's deeply embedded in the brain. Our challenge is to understand each other. Thank you.
That was Helen Fisher, recorded at the TED Conference in Monterey, California, February 2008. For more information on TED, visit TED.com.
We are back, and I'm happy that LBM was able to finally make it in. Very, very, very appreciative. Most of the time, she's just finishing up with some, you know, the very important work that she does as a wife and a mother, and she's, you know, handing off the baton and still, you know, sprinting by the time she joins us, and so... this is yet another occasion, and she actually has a story to tell that she thinks is apropos to the theme of what we were going to discuss today that has to do with why she was a little bit later than I expected her. Not that she, you know, had any commitment that she had to be here at any given time, but I thought we'd lead off with that. You there, LBM?
Yes.
Great. Give us the story. Yeah, give us the story. What happened tonight?
I am here, and I mean, this is, like, not a great thing to relay, but I felt like it was somewhat in line with what we had discussed last week, and I actually told this friend that I was going to relay the story, and, you know, after I say it, I'll say to you why it was so devastating for me to hear.
Okay.
So I just came from spending time with a friend who had been going out with this guy for a good year, seeing this guy regularly, you know, sleepovers, her place, his place,
mm-hmm.
for a year. And she is literally in the bed, can't get up, because after a year of seeing this person, what she thinks was regularly, the person told her in the bed that he was marrying someone else.
Oh, wow. Oof. Ah.
Now, here's the thing, Cree. This is like the third time in my adult life that I've heard this story.
Man.
This is the third time that I have heard this story.
Oof.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Wow. Okay. Where did we start?
I mean, and I'm just like, I said, wow, you know, because, you know, my plan was, you know, of course, to come home and, you know, do my family thing and, you know, get ready to come on with you, because I was very interested in continuing the line of conversation from last week when the brother called in and said that he couldn't see actually telling a woman that he, you know, he loved her.
Right.
And I wanted to get more into that. So, you know, you can imagine when, you know, I heard this. And like I said, this is like the third time.
Wow.
That I've heard over the years.
What does she know about this person with whom he is now betrothed? Does she know anything?
No.
Wow.
No. And the last time that I heard this story, the person actually gave the woman, the black woman, an invitation to his wedding in the bed.
Oh, no, let me ask you a question. The other two times, was the announcement made in the bed?
Yes, the time before now, it was. That's the story I just relayed. The time before that, it wasn't. He just, you know, she was told, you know, on a regular, you know, outing or whatever. The second time she was told in the bed, was given an invitation to the wedding. And this time she was just told that, you know, he just told her that he's getting married, such and such a date, blah, 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 blah.
Wow. Okay.
Exactly.
She's
shuttered in.
Okay, let's see if we can work our way up from the bottom brick, okay? I didn't have time, but I wanted to upload a piece that some people who are familiar with other radio programs may know, the work of someone who calls himself Seed Planner. He'd done a little riff, and it would have been nice to play that as part of the music. And it starts out with a quote by Malcolm X, in which he says, "Black women are the most disrespected people on the planet."
Mm-hmm.
And
yes, I do remember that. I remember him saying that.
So, but when you tell somebody that, when you, first of all, when you carry on as if you're any reasonable person would think, I mean, even if we would go with contractual law, which is silly, but I'm just using it as a way to analyze it. This would be something called estoppel or implied contract. Any reasonable person would assume that given the circumstances, there was some sort of exclusivity. But even if there weren't exclusivity, there was an investment in the relationship in which you wouldn't just have sexual relations with the person and then tell them, well, you're going to marry someone else. So you,
right.
So you kind of think, well, that's like talk about the ultimate and just not regarding anyone's feelings. And talk about what we talked about last week about, you know, really using someone in a really sadistic way for their orifice. But this has the feel, this story and the one before it, and maybe even the one before that, has the feel of something beyond that. This is more than just sort of a benign, I don't care how you feel, because that could have been said after, you know what I mean? The person still would have felt really bad about it. It's like, you know, you have sex with me, and then you tell me after that you're going to marry someone else. That still would have put you in the, you know, put you back, you know, with some Theraflu and be shuttered in. But that is a normal thing to do if you're just taking advantage of someone and you don't care about how they feel generally. But to tell them while you're laying in the bed with them, that is mean-spirited. That's sadistic.
Beyond. And I really, you know, the whole time that I was riding home on the train, I'm saying, you know, I have to ask you. See if you can answer this, because I hate to take a single situation and then make a general statement from that. I generally don't like when people do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I just had to ask. Because we've asked this question before. I mean, this is the whole crux of why we even, you know, dig into these topics. And the question continues to be, to what extent can we be mentally prepared to fight racism, white domination, if we're not taking care of each other emotionally?
Right. We can't. See,
I mean, if we're hurting each other like that, I mean, wow. And now what? This person is supposed to be in the mind state to observe and, you know, combat the system. Forget it.
Yeah, because once you've undergone that kind of trauma, it's not even really about recovering from this particular trauma. This is a trauma that stays with you. This is a trauma that handicaps you really permanently.
And you know, I don't want to go. I was just thinking about several things in terms of following up from last week, and I was just thinking about a lot of different things. And you know, one of the things that I was thinking about, and you know, I know people may get a little annoyed with me always taking things back to the plantation, but you know, it's one of my peeves, and it's just something. It's a system that I really feel like we have not studied really the abject cruelty of that system enough. We haven't studied it anywhere near sufficiently. And I was just, after last week, I was just thinking, you know, the position that the enslaved woman was in. And, you know, I think I mentioned last week how, you know, we have to remember that, you know, she wasn't only raped by the white master. She was also, you know, raped by fellow enslaved males. And, you know, I just don't think any real amount of effort has been made to understand the trials and tribulations of the black woman in America. I don't. I think that needs to be said, and I don't want it to be my trauma is worse than your trauma, or, you know, that kind of comparison. But I think that we have acknowledged and continue to acknowledge, you know, the quote unquote plight of the black man. But I don't think that we have come near to trying to understand and be compassionate about and understanding about the plight of the black woman. I don't think so.
Well, I obviously agree with you there. I mean, that takes it a whole different place for me. I was at, and we still might get there. I thought that what I had to offer in terms of a question is how to answer that paradox of what to expect from a black male in terms of his stability in the job market, or if you want to pretend like it actually exists in any significant numbers, the business entrepreneurial side. But this is a more basic one. This gets back to, I heard someone tell me, well, someone told me that they were very offended when I used the word sexual toilet, and it was, actually it was a couple black males who told me that. And it skimmed over my head at the time, but then after I thought about it, I thought, oh, well, what do you mean you're offended? And my sense wasn't that these males were offended or hurt for the black females. My sense after I thought about it was that they're offended that any black female could regard anything that issues from them as being mm-hmm. worthy of going into a toilet. Not that our bodies mm-hmm. would be regarded as the toilet, but that mm-hmm. but that anything that issues from them should be considered something holy and sacred and it's a sacrament. And how could you possibly refer to it as something that should be disposed of? That was my sense of where it's coming from. But I want to get back to the mean-spiritedness. See, it's one thing. It's a one level of it's a level of hurt when the person thinks so little of you is to not regard your feelings at all. That's rather how I feel when when black males make, by now, what is these famous statements like, she's so pretty to be dark, or when they present their white or non-black girlfriends, bring them home to their mothers and their around their sisters and cousins.
Mm-hmm.
That's one level. Did not even think that that might be incredibly hurtful. That's
mm-hmm.
one level.
Right,
and matter of fact, that hurts to me, although I understand if I were in your friend's position, I would be in her position, in a fetal position.
Right.
But
because
I'm not, I'm stepping back some, and I'm like,
right.
That, see, the opposite of love is not hate. And what he did was a hateful thing.
Right.
The opposite of love is indifference. So when black males walk in with these non-black females and just say these things off the top of their heads without thinking, that's an indifference that's more hurtful to me. You know, they just don't care about this, don't regard what we think enough to even consider our feelings. But what this guy did tonight was hateful.
Right.
Because, of course, it could have been done in any, if he just wanted to have the sex one or two or three or four last times and still make this business arrangement or decide that he's going to, you know, marry this other female, there are so many other circumstances in which he could have told her he was going to do that. Or he could have not told her at all, you know, just slinked off, and that would have been hurtful, and he would have never returned her phone call. That would have been hurtful. But this takes it to another level. You're going to be in the bed with the person, and that's like burning a child with a lighter or something.
That wasn't this time.
Oh, that was not this time.
This one that I was with tonight. She wasn't told in the bed, literally. Whereas the one before, you know, years back, she was told literally in the bed after doing the do.
Okay, that was hateful. So what happened?
She was given the invitation in the bed.
That's a level of mental.
I think this was, you know, the final act itself wasn't, you know, equally as hateful, because I mean he didn't do it in the bed after the act, but the fact that, you know, after a year of, you know, seeing this person, you know, at least 2-3 times a week from what I could gather, you know, having, I guess, what she thought was no reason to believe that, you know, they weren't exclusive, but I don't even.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about. I mean, this is difficult because I want to be sensitive, and but I also want to, hopefully through our dialogue we can be helpful too, and so gosh, you know, this is somebody that I hate to quote, but I mean, it's just basic logic. You can't be assuming things in relationships. Because, of course...
Exactly.
Of course, he knew what she wanted to believe, and he knew what she had been led by him to believe, but he also knew that there was fine print.
That if he didn't actually make the statement...
Right, that's exactly right.
Which is... You know, which, yeah, and that's what I thought about even in terms of last week when the young man said, I wouldn't want to actually verbalize, you know, to whatever extent it is I'm feeling for this woman. And I really felt like, you know, not being able to talk to him any further, but I just feel like that really pertains to black women, because I feel like...
Go ahead with it.
I was listening to Gus's program on the Jasper, Texas situation, and I'm saying, you know, this black man is in this town, this obviously racist town, and he's willing to be in this town where a black man was dragged to death, decapitated, and he's willing to be in this town with this white woman. So he's willing to take that chance to be with this white woman, which is an obvious, you know, declaration of something very deeply emotional.
It means I'm willing to die. I'm willing to die for you.
Right.
Which is what we discussed last week.
On the other hand, you know, a segment of black males saying, well, I'm not willing to say I love you to a black woman. And I'm real disturbed, and maybe my thinking is a little scattered right now, but I don't think so. I'm just, you know.
No, I think you're on target.
Someone would have to tell me something else, but, you know, I've just seen too many occasions where, you know, black males have been willing to openly, you know, profess their love for non-black women. And so it's, you know, this is a problem.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. And
it's a problem.
It's about
and
where we're going to start. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's not a back burner issue in terms of the fight against racism, white domination. You know, I mean, for me, that's, you know, that's the goal.
But I even feel like
meaning that we can't even
no.
pursue that goal, not really.
No,
As long as you're willing to have this type of lack of regard for each
right.
other.
And I even feel like the lack of willingness to make it a front burner issue, the inclination to say things like, well, this is a minor thing, we're in a war, don't be worrying about that. I mean, that seems silly, you know. I even think that is actually a contemptuous regard for black females, because I just don't think that type of thing is done for non-black females and wouldn't be done. And that's just, hey, that's I'm calling them like I see it. So now it's like, when do we stop taking it? You know, it's like this. It's really rather like what Fuller says about produce justice or kill us all. And if you make the decision to kill us all, you're going up against whatever created you. And if whatever created us decides that we shouldn't be here, well, then we shouldn't be here anyway. But we're ready to say that we're not going to exist like this anymore, either because justice is produced or because we won't be here anymore. But this is going to stop. So it's rather like that. It's rather like us saying, you know, we're not going to go along to get along anymore. We realize, it's very tough. I really think this is where we have to be as black females. We realize that once we take this stand, we may not ever stand next to a male again. We realize that we may never be chosen. We realize that we may never give birth again. But I'll be damned if you'll use my vagina like this anymore. No more.
But you know what? We will be chosen, and we will be stood next to, and it will be by a better grade of male. But we have to go through that initial fire of, like, shutting it down.
Well, that's my sense, too. You know, and every time I've ever raised that, they go, no, that's wrong. You can't do that. No, that's wrong. That's like, no, you can't. Hey, male and female have to work through it together. I don't even, you know, that's my
Well,
sense.
I think that is working through it together.
I think
that's the best help that we can give, because like you said, although he allowed this assumption to go on, he never actually said, you know, I'm with you exclusively, and, you know, at some point in time, you know, I would like to be married, and when that time comes, it will be you. Or, you know, none of that was actually verbalized, like you said. And so, you know, what are you saying, that she should have gotten that, at least that verbalization from him, at some point sooner than a year later?
Yeah, well, that's
right?
The minimum.
Okay, so.
Well, yeah, that's the minimum, is the verbalization, but you can't stop there.
Right.
I mean, my stepbrother said that to me, and he scared me. Oh, boy, did he scare me. My stepbrother's quite a bit younger than me. He's about 15, 16 years younger than me. My mother and I have a couple things in common, if you get my drift. And maybe you don't. If you don't, you don't.
I get your drift.
Okay. And so he scared me because he just was telling me this the way he... Now, some of the stuff that he does on women wouldn't work on me. But some of that stuff scared me because I'm like, you know, I'm pretty. It's pretty tough to get through my gauntlet. But I don't know. That some of that stuff might have worked on me. But one of the things that he said was... that it's the easiest thing in the world is to tell someone you love them. That's easy. But it's a start. I mean, if you can't even get them to say that, and for me, it's not just to say you love them. I need to hear you say, you know, you're in love with me. Now, because you can kind of read somebody's face. I mean, there maybe 30% of a good liar will get through that, but most people will kind of wince. Most brothers will kind of wince to lie like that. But so that's one level. But then you have to prove it by something, too. So that's the next level of the conversation. And I think that's where we left off last week is beyond saying that, what do you do to prove that? And then what I said is my definition of love is that that you're willing to die for a person. So, of course, that can apply to anyone. And you said you were willing to die for your offspring. And then I said my definition of in love is also that you crave being with that person more than you even crave having sex with them, of course, and that you're willing to die for them. How does one, if one accepted that, and I don't know that you do or even think that you do accept that definition of love between a male and a female. If one sets that definition, and then someone says a black male says to you, I love you, you know, I'm in love with you. How does he prove to you, you know, because what I said is that you shouldn't say it unless you're pretty sure you're willing to die for the person. How does he prove to you that he's willing to do that?
I thought about that for a little while afterwards. And, I'm not sure. I think that I would say that in the opposite way, that, you know, if you really love a person, then you're willing to live for them. I have to work it out, but I'm not sure that it's all that hard to die versus to live.
Oh, come on. It's the hardest thing in the world. It's the hardest thing. People say that, you know, this is not supposed to be a mental health show, but it's all tied in. There's this myth out there that people who commit suicide are cowards, that's an easy thing out to do. That's an easy way out. Of course, that is totally false. The strongest thing that any creature has is the instinct of survival. So to willingly give that up takes more courage than anything one could possibly have, because there's no stronger instinct than to survive by any means necessary. So when one is willingly puts down their life just because what they deem as a quality of life is greater than what they're existing, and that's not a just, that's very courageous. And even
right,
more so, when they do it because doing so is necessary to sustain the existence of another that they say they love. That's extremely courageous.
But I think that are you there?
Yeah, I'm trying to do some audio quality things, so when I'm not talking, I take the mic off, but yeah, I'm right here.
Right. I think that's a different stream than I think that's a different stream than where I am, because in terms of what I was saying to the young man last week, in terms of loving someone enough to want to be willing to fight this fight with them, you know, I don't, you know, it doesn't help me, and it doesn't really show me love that you would I don't want to say necessarily take your life, but you know, I'm more interested in you wanting to live for me and with me than you willing to die.
Well, see, to me, if you're willing to die, then all the other stuff is a piece of cake. You know, for me, it's like, if I can see your...
You should be willing to die for yourself. In terms of fighting to have a certain quality of a just quality of life, yes. And if you do that for yourself, then you know ultimately you will be doing it for me as well.
Yeah, I'm gonna agree with that.
I just would want more of that spirit of we're going to fight this fight together, and we're going to hang in, and we're not going to run at the first sign of trouble or stress, or because, you know, that's what the system is. It's trouble and stress, you know?
Ain't that right? But I hear what you're saying.
So how much effort is going to be too much effort? You know what I mean?
Okay, so now that gets
that's going to show me how much you love me. Effort to be too much effort?
Well, now, okay, that's definitely true. There's a Taking the Journey. It's an online magazine, and the creator of the online mag has a Facebook page, and his name is Craig Butts, and so he usually will have a relationship question of the day to let him know I mentioned him. And his relationship question of today, was it? No, I think it was yesterday. Was he will usually present questions that other readers or people he knows have posed to him. And it was, I'm tired of hearing sisters, black females, whether it's girlfriends, wives, mothers, sisters, what have you, say, you could make it if you just try harder. If you just tried harder, you could do something of yourself. Just try harder. And so the question was, when will black females understand that many of us are doing the best we can? We just can't get anywhere. When will they understand we are trying? And, you know, I had a response to that. But what that generated for me is this paradox. And the paradox is that... And I'm not sure that we agree on this, LBM, but it's a paradox for me. On the one hand, I don't want you to just be a wimp, you know? I don't want you to just say, this is too hard, I can't try anymore, it's too hard. You go, it's easier for you. I don't want that. Of course, who wants that? On the other hand, this is going to be a tough one, and only a few people, I think, are going to agree with me. In the past, when I was talking with, contemplating dating or dating a black guy, and I asked him this, you know, whatever line of work he was in, I asked him this question. For me, this is the litmus test, right? So I asked the question, how's it going on your job? What's it like? You know, whether they were a university professor or whatnot. What was your last performance review like? What normally happens to you under those? It's pretty tough out there. You're pretty tough at the university. And if he told me, oh no, not me. I'm right on tenure track, or not me. No, I always get fantastic performance reviews. I was always disappointed. My eyebrow always raised. That was pretty much a sinker for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that black males who do not shuffle, who do not in some way cower through their body language and their tone, who aren't all giggles, you know, they don't have to be Huey P. Newton, but
right.
It could be a quiet confidence. Just be a normal person with a normal amount of masculinity. If you're a black male, they're going to give you hell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most, and I can't deal with that. So it's like, on the one hand, I don't want to hear that it's easy for you, because then I know what I'm dealing with. I'm dealing with someone who giggles a lot, who all, you know, in some way is feminine, and in some way who giggles a lot, gives in a lot, is effeminate, is always looking down, is soft-spoken when he shouldn't be. He can't represent for me. I don't want that, but then I know that those kind of guys who have a normal amount of masculinity are going to have a hard way to go, and they aren't going to have much. It's a paradox. So what do you do?
Well, I think I can agree with what you've just said. I can agree with what you just said, but I think that black males are going to have to pull on their creativity and be clear, as Elijah Muhammad said, you know, I don't know, 50 years ago, that you the white man will not be having you in his offices. You know, he will not be having you in the same spaces with him and, you know, his women. So, you know, and I mean, this was, you know, whatever it was before, you know, my time, a little bit anyway, that Elijah Muhammad told black men this. So I think that it has to come out of that box of literally having to go to this white dominator for sustenance, or for, you know, his ability to be productive. It has to go beyond that.
Well, that's the logic.
So it's not so much just try harder in terms of try harder to quote unquote get a job, but try harder to think of ways that you can be productive and do what you need to do.
For example, I mean, because it gets down to bread and butter. It really gets down to if you're living, well,
for
it gets
example,
down to, yeah.
For example, right now, I know, being here in New York, I know several black males that worked in the financial area prior to the quote-unquote crash, who are now out of work. And they have their MBAs and, you know, whatever degrees that they have. And almost to the last of those particular brothers that I know, they've been out of work for the last 2 to 3 years. And they've been out of work for the last 2 to 3 years. Whereas all the brothers that I know who are tradesmen and or otherwise, I guess what you would call hustlers, they always seem to find something to do to make some money.
Hmm.
And they do. They get out here and they hit the streets. I mean, I know them. I mean, my husband is one of them. But I know several of them that if they're not doing this, they're doing that. You know? Legally. And they're doing what they have to do because they have commitments to, you know, their wives, their, you know, their children, whatever their situation is. And they're not bound by a degree that says I'm supposed to be working here or there or in this field or in that area. A man does what he has to do.
Okay. Now there's someone who wants to join the conversation, and I want to. It's a block caller, so I'm going to open their mic in just a second. First, hello? Hello? LBM, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. My logic is that there's a tipping point for everything. So there's a tipping point for when white folks move out of a neighborhood. There's a tipping point for when they allow black folks to do independent type business kind of work before they somehow seize upon it, you know, one way or another, by making it illegal, by making it illegal to have carts on the sidewalk, what have you.
Absolutely. By bombing,
you know. And so right now there's a small enough number of black males who are doing that to where they're allowed to do it. But if we're talking about the large number of black males, the greatest majority of them, who white men do not want in their offices. If all of them started doing that, we would start to have a problem. There would be a shutdown.
We have a problem now, though. But we have a problem now.
Yeah, I'm not really sure.
We have a problem now.
I totally agree.
If he's saying, you know, I can't because, you know, this white male won't let me, I can't because that's a problem. So we have a problem now. You see, so, I mean, it goes back to something you said many, many podcasts ago, but, you know, it stays with me. How long are we going to make it easy for these people to dominate us?
Now
At least let's not make it easy.
Right, okay. Yes, let's. Because they might miss and their arms might get tired swinging. I'm with you. Okay, I'm digging that. All right, let me let this block caller in. If that's you, your mic is hot.
Okay, am I on?
Yes, you are.
Okay. I'm taking a look at your description, and you're talking about picking up the conversation from last week, discussing the functional value and definition of erotic love, in quotes, between black males and black females, while under the construct of global white domination. Am I getting this right? Are you saying that for some reason white supremacy has now invaded the black bedroom?
Oh, sure. It invades every second that we breathe. It invades everything that we do. Yes.
All right. So in some way, white supremacy is contaminating the love, which you have in quotes, between black guys and black girls, right? If I'm understanding that right, can you explain that to me if you haven't already explained it? Because
I'm not sure that you need an explanation. Let me find out if you are a white person. Are you a white person, sir?
I am who I am. What I am, who I am, has no relevance to the message that I'd either like to convey or the message you'd like to try to give to me.
That would be your position. My position would be the opposite of that, which is that if, in fact, you are a white person,
mm-hmm.
you don't need me to explain anything about how white supremacy works. And, in fact, your request that I do is probably a further practice of it because you are causing me to use my time and effort in a non-economic and productive fashion. You don't need me to explain it to you.
So then,
it has been my experience that people who decline to say whether or not
mm-hmm.
they are white in almost every case, are in fact white.
Then assume I'm black then, okay? Assume I'm black, and that you can then take the time to explain to me what it is that you're saying.
Well, I don't know if I'm willing to assume that you're black because you were hesitant to say that at the beginning. So I don't think that I'm willing to do that. LBM, if you're willing to do that, you can explain it to the gentleman.
No, not hardly.
Thank you for calling, sir.
So you're not going to explain it to me?
No, sir. Now I accidentally cut LBM off. LBM, you got to call me back. I think we touched the nerve. Let me see if I can get her back. Bear with me here.
My dick and my boobies, my heart, my soul.
there's a demonstration of how white folks will try to interrupt anything constructive that black folks are trying to do, especially to try to counter the system of racism and white supremacy. So I've gotten a little flustered because I have not been able to get LBM back on the line. Thought she was going to be able to dial back in. I'm going to keep trying, though. We're not going to let them do it without fighting. So let me keep trying. LBM, if you're listening, I'm trying to Skype you. Played a lot of music this program. Come on. Let's try again. Have to be persevering. Okay. A little bit more music. What? What are the worst technical snafus ever in the history of the Cree program? One. Thank you. we're back. And we know if at first you don't succeed, try again. So we weren't going to let them. We have to persevere under this construct.
So listen. In terms of I think we're on some kind of flow here, so I hate to take it back, but I do want to get your – what do you think about the fact that this is not the first time that I've heard this situation play out?
Oh,
I mean, this is like the third time in you know, like the last 20 years that I've heard this particular – you know, of course, people are breaking up and, you know, moving on all the time, or quote unquote cheating on each other or whatever. But this is particularly cruel thing.
Yeah, let me tell you what's coming to me as it's coming to me. At first, I was going to say, well, gosh, I hadn't thought of it, but I'll tell you what's coming from me, and it's coming in really clear. It's black males calling our bluff. They're calling our bluff. It's almost like you're begging for someone to stand up for themselves. You're begging for somebody to put their foot down. Because, see, you know, they're not going to be whole either until we're whole. And as long as we're willing to walk around with one sock on, you know, and half a blouse, and wear high heels and makeup and put cologne over it, everybody's accepting that. But somewhere in them, I don't think it's actually that conscious, but somewhere in them, they're begging us to put our foot down in ways that only we can do. They can't do it for us. It's almost like, I know how this is going to sound, but it'll just sound like it is. There are roles. Males and females have roles. And I don't know why it is that pilots respond more favorably to a female voice in the cockpit telling them there's something wrong. They get very competitive when it's a male voice. They're likely to dismiss it and say there's not anything wrong. But when a female voice, that's why they use female voices in cockpits, when a female voice comes in and says, you know, whatever is wrong with whatever on the instruments, the males will listen. There's a certain authority that only females carry, especially as regards to us. And we've been kicked down and dragged through everything by racist man and racist woman. And black males, because they are weaker in that way, there are certain ways that males are weaker than females. There are certain ways that females are weaker than males. But in terms of setting boundaries about what behavior is appropriate for in a family, that's for females. And you know, the kids can run amok. The people of lower social authority can run amok, and no one can straighten that out except for us. And they're almost like in an unconscious way begging. It's like a child who's just acting out. And we just keep going along, and they're just like, you know, no matter what I tell you, you go along with it. No matter what I tell you, what I don't tell you, you go along with what's unsaid. When do we put our foot down? That's my sense.
And you think that we actually have that foot to put down?
I do. The foot to put down is just to say...
Without any assistance from them.
No, without
from
any
black
assistance.
Male.
No, without any assistance. And all it is just self-respect. It's just self-respect. It's just, if I never, ever see a bare-chested man, if I never get a hug again in my life, I am not going to take this. Is if I allow you to enter my body, you're going to have demonstrated a lot. I may get it wrong once in a while, but no more. This is not cheap anymore. Now, you may tell me for a long time, well, then okay, because your stuff isn't worth anything anyway. You can tell me that, and I'll say okay, but it's worth something to me.
Mm-hmm.
So if I die without ever having a phallus inserted into me, then that's what it is, because you will not use me as a toilet anymore. And when our daughters get that, mm-hmm. when these black females can get that, that's what they, you know, they don't think much of themselves, so they allow themselves to be used that way. You know, when they can get that they are worth something to themselves, if nobody else, and that's it. I'm not going to allow you to just walk over me like this and pretend like what I have isn't important and just go into this fantasy realm anymore. Stay strong. Deal with reality. There's every indication he thinks nothing of you. So don't let him in. It's just not worth it. That's the foot we have to put down. You there?
I am here. I am here. And I mean, I don't disagree with what you're saying. I certainly don't disagree with what you're saying. You know, I'm just still wondering. I don't know about having that foot without, I don't know. How does that differ? How does what you're saying differ from putting the whole, you have a segment of black male out here who are saying that, you know, the demise or the decrepitness of the black community is on the shoulders of the black woman. Because it's like, what would you say if you know, someone says to you, okay, so what you're saying is they're not going to do right until we change.
I think that's the reality, yes. I think that's the reality. So, but I understand what you're saying is like that somehow that makes it our fault. It doesn't make it our fault. See, that's like saying this. That's like saying that white folks have mistreated us for millennia, and there's every indication that they are not going to produce justice. They're just not going to do it. So if justice is going to be produced, it's going to be produced by us. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean that because there is no justice, it's black folks' fault. It just means that the people who are mistreating aren't ever going to stop, and so it's just in our hands. But that doesn't mean that it's our fault that the planet is in the condition vis-a-vis people that it's in. It's the same thing between black males and black females. It's not our fault, the condition of our relationships or our attempted families. That's not our fault at all. It's just that there's every indication that black males are not going to do anything to repair it. They're not in a position, they're not going to do it. So we're going to have to do it.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. At the same time, as far as I'm concerned, white folk are subhuman. And it is just not in their nature. It's not what they are to produce justice. They are here to perpetuate this system of injustice. It's not in them. It's just not in them, as far as I'm concerned. So now, if we're going to use that same analogy, you know, are you saying that it's just not in black males to behave justly towards black females unless we
force that out
of them?
In the main, that is what I'm saying. In the main, what I am saying is that males are not good at boundaries. They will go as far as you let them go. In the main, that is my belief that is how they're put
males
here.
Males in general.
That's,
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
This is, you know, to round out my point, this is why you'll find them out on all the tails of the bell curves. You'll find females bunched in the middle. Males are all the way out there on all those tails, both negatively and positively in terms of genetics. They are, by nature, not observers of boundaries. They can enforce boundaries, but they don't observe them. They just don't see them. That's just not their thing. They don't do them. They don't get social cues.
Okay, so how does that play out in terms of what I just said to you when you said that this person on another program said that we don't understand that they're trying? And I said to you, well, they will have to try harder in different ways. Are you saying that person is saying, well, it's just not in us, it's just not in them to try any harder?
No.
Then they've tried.
No. Not knowing.
So if we don't set a boundary saying this is what is required, then you're saying that at some point, then none of them are going to make an effort to be productive males for the black family.
Never none. There are always exceptions. Never none. There are always exceptions, but in the main, not enough to make a difference. Not enough to make a difference.
Good Lord, Cree. It's like I'm always willing to go there, but you're always willing to go beyond, and then that makes me have to say, dang. I thought I was rough, but you're like.
But listen, you just came back from confronting. You're telling me.
I know. Trust me. That's. I'm trying to come from there. Wow.
Yeah, I hear some of these writers, and you know which ones I speak. They do a lot of cursing and talk about who's left at the welfare office and all that stuff's true. And you know, one thing she said to me. And I didn't like it. But I knew there was some truth to it, too. I just didn't think that it, of course I didn't think it applied to me at the moment. A well-known writer who has whenever she posts anything on Facebook, it blows up. But I didn't think it applied to me at the moment. But what she said is that, you know, you coddle. You make excuses. And you're weak. And this is why they run all over you. Well, I didn't think that applied to me at the moment. I just thought, you don't have to be discourteous. You don't have to curse at them. I don't think that's necessary. In fact, I don't even think that works. Okay? But, yeah, there's a time to be rough. You have to.
Oh, I don't disagree with that.
Well, and rough means to just be brutally honest. Brutally honest. Meaning, brutal just means I can't. Because see, there's a quality about nerds. Bear with me here; it's connected. I'm not sure if it's Steven Pinker who I referenced last week, but it's some neurobiologist.
I believe it was him. I'm pretty sure it was. I remember the name.
Who said the following quote? Who said, "To be male is to be a little bit autistic." AUTISTIC. Autism is a disorder in which you have trouble with relationships. You have trouble reading cues. You have trouble understanding a theory of mind, trouble understanding other people, what other people might be thinking. To be male is to be peculiarly, in compared to females, a little bit like that. That is why when they do those laboratory studies and they have a series of photographs in which the person's mood was known at the time it was snapped, so you can see these faces that are associated with these moods, and then they ask the participants to identify the mood of the person in that photograph. Females way outscore males. Now, there's some things that males way outscore females on, but I'm just talking about, we're talking about relationships here, okay? So to be, when you're, a nerd is someone who is somewhere on that autistic spectrum disorder. They just don't get cues. You know, I had a nerd, quote-unquote, friend in college, and no matter how many times, how many hints you would get, you've been in my dorm room our dorm room here for 6 hours. Nothing you're saying is important. We're getting ready to go to sleep now. Okay, I'm getting tired. No matter how heavy the hint you throw them, a nerd, they just don't get it. You have to tell them straight out, I don't want you to come here anymore. I don't want to see you here for another 2 weeks. It's okay if you come 1 hour every month. Okay? You can't stay until, and don't come after this time. You can't throw hints at them.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be what people think is brutally honest because they don't get it otherwise. There comes a time with males, because to be male is to be somewhat autistic. In certain conditions, that autistic tendency, and again, I'm talking about in generalities. Of course, there are exceptions. It builds upon itself in certain conditions, and under these conditions of white domination, black males dealing with black females just going further and further and further and further and further, not reading our discomfort, not reading our pain, to where now we're imploding and exploding inside, to where, yeah, we're going to have to be brutally honest, like you have to be with a nerd or an autistic person, because we're not autistic. And they're never going to see it otherwise. Now, they can be trained. There's children, I've forgotten what age, but preschool age children can have what's called, I've forgotten what it's called, but it's a certain form of therapy where they can, their brains can be trained to operate more normally if you catch them early enough. I think the brain is very, very plastic. It's our job as females to deal with that plasticity in the brains of males, to make them more sensitive to our feelings and what we're thinking.
I understand what you're saying. And you're making a general statement about males in general,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay. Just like when we listen to, Helen Fisher or the other guy that we listen to, or any of these non-black white folk, analysis or whatever, they are talking about people in general, or what they understand to be the human in general.
Yeah.
So now what happens, not only what happens to our ability to function as humans, and particularly as African humans who are supposed to be able to operate on this higher level, what has happened to us under this system, that what you're saying we have to do as black women and what you're saying they have to respond to as black males, how much is that corrupted, is what I'm saying. What I mean, you're saying they can't do what they will ultimately have to do until we do what we have to do. But this system has crippled us as well. So now where are we going to get that leg to put down within this system? It's necessary. It's going to have to happen. I got that. It is definitely going to have to happen if we're going to move anywhere near, getting rid of this system. So it is going to have to happen. But where is it going to come from under these layers of victimization?
I think that's the place where you have it. That's where it's coming from, is a place of growth. I think that emotional growth, which is usually, located somewhere in your body, somewhere in your brain, is you have to have breakthrough moments from just pure training of it. just like physical growth, you know, just like when you're working out and you hit a threshold and then you just you keep training it until you break through and you have what's called supercompensation. That's where you get to the point where you really are dealing with the fact that we're using such a small percentage of our brain, that we really, the history of our species, and I'm talking about black folk,
mm-hmm.
but the history of every species as it's evolved, but the history of our species has always been because we have been able to transcend what had previously been thought as a barrier that no one could break through.
Mm-hmm.
So we're at a place where we got to grow again, where we got to evolve, where we got to get stronger.
Mm-hmm.
There's no choice.
Right. Right, right. Right, okay.
Or we won't be here anymore.
Right.
And as someone as old as I am, it's easy for me to say, you know, but I still fear death. I don't fear it as much as I used to, you know. I've never feared it greatly, because I don't think as much as most people,
I don't, you know, I actually don't fear death. I don't fear death. I do fear my children having to live their whole lives under this system. That I do fear.
Well, you're stronger than me. I fear that more than I fear death. But, I mean, I can't
That's
say.
What I'm,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if I see a Mack truck coming at me, I can't say my heart doesn't beat fast. Like, I'll say a lot of it. No, you know, it matters to me. That's instinct.
Well, yeah.
But yeah, we're going to have to. But and it, I guess my point in saying that is that we got to face that. You have to deal with your ultimate fear of death. What's it worth to you? What is the quality of existence beneath which you do not define as life?
Right. Right.
And the way we're getting treated right now by our own kind, by our counterparts, is just not, you know. No, it's not tolerable. It's just intolerable. We can't do it anymore. If what is going to happen is that there will not be any brown-skinned people, because you can't just say there won't be any brown-skinned females, because, you know, right now the system is selecting for the lighter you are. Okay, that's what the system is selecting for in terms of females, more so than males. But, of course, when that happens, then the offspring will be, you know, an equal mix of males and females. If that means that's what's going to happen, then that's what's going to happen. But brown-skinned females got to shut. They got to shut their legs. And not out of vengeance. It's not
right.
about vengeance. It's not what it's
not.
About at all. It's just not about. It's about self-respect. There is a quality of existence that you have when you treat yourself with respect. When you know you treated yourself with respect, other people don't have to. To join you in that. But when you treat yourself with respect, you know, there's a certain peace that comes with that. And not coincidentally, which is, you know, if we get what we want out of it, we may just be out of here. But if we're not out of here, things are, you know, we're back on the road to balance.
Mm-hmm.
And we just got to face that. So with all this talk, all of this haranguing that we hear from black males predominantly, that our fecundity levels are falling and we're having less and less females come. We got to propagate so that we can compete against white folks. They're trying to keep us to keep us from having babies. You know, stop it. We're not going to have babies for you under these conditions. For what? For what?
Okay, so along that line, when you heard this, when you heard this person say that black women don't understand that black men are trying and that they just can't try anymore, what was your response to that?
I'm going to go right to it.
What has been your response to that?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. You're so on point, like almost all the time. I'm going to read it. Let me scroll down and find it. Let Jeopardy play in your mind for a bit so I can find this, because I want to make sure that I say it exactly. Okay. Okay. When he asked, when will black women stop saying this and understand that we are trying, my response was as follows. It will stop When black females get a basic understanding of the global system of racism, white domination, then and only then, and when that happens, black males will stop pursuing, fantasizing, and romanticizing non-black females over black ones. Ultimately, no relationship between black people. I hate it when they do that. Ultimately, no relationship between black people can be the quality it should be until the system of white/light domination has been replaced with one of justice. Scientific research on study ideas has shown that when just 10% of a group of people hold an unshakable belief and share that belief will always be adopted by the majority of that group. To that end, I recommend that all black males who want black females to understand that it is more difficult for them to get employment or to start businesses than black females listen to or read the work of Neely Fuller Jr. I advise all black females who want black males to stop cherishing all things less black and females to do the same. Help us get to the tipping point. Become part of that 10% and go about planting seeds. That's what I said.
Mm.
Hello. Oh, ma'am, did I lose you? Did you accidentally mute yourself? Hmm. Yeah, you're gone. Okay, your router must have left. Let me see if I can dial you back. I think your router went off. Call failed. It feels like a little bit awkward to put more music on, and not sure what else can be said here. I guess my point there is, I'll try one more time, but my point is that there's an economy. Economics is just the use of time and effort. And as Dr. William Darity, who did Economics of Marriage, he called it Shedding Light on Marriage, and he talked about, he did a whole economic, he's out of Duke University, study on the value in a lifetime, both towards marriage and in terms of earning capacity of mates, that light skin has for black females. So if you want to talk about economics, if black males want to talk about how difficult economically it is to be a black male to be employed, then they need to understand the other side of that equation on the female version, which is that you deal with white supremacy, you want us to deal with and understand white supremacy in order to support this idea that we have to do something else other than what we're doing in order for you to be able to support the mate that you choose and the offspring that you produce. But by the same token, you've got to understand the economics of white supremacy in terms of what it does to your behavior in seeking all things lighter. And we need to do both. And we're not going to do one without the other. But why do we need to it becomes just a ridiculous thing for us to just keep supporting your ability to do that, to produce offspring, and when what we're producing is something that's going to come back and hate us. You know, we're almost becoming mammies for our own offspring. It needs to be dealt with. Both sides need to be dealt with. And it looks like unless we deal with our side, you're never going to get your side right. And I guess I'm speaking as a female, two males. Let me try one more time to contact LBM. Other than that, we'll close out. All failed. Okay. We'll be back next week, next Thursday. Hopefully, we've got a tentative date set for Dr. Carlos, but it's his agent did tell me it was tentative for him to be back next Thursday. So I'm not really sure what kind of program we're going to have next Thursday. We'll have something. And I just want folks to know, I'll say publicly how much I appreciate LBM. And we might have some art. I won't tell you what kind of art, but art on theme. And this might be the theme of what the CREEP program does for quite a while in funky counter-racism. So this is as funky as it gets. So I think we'll call it a night and just say that I hope that you will stay as safe as possible and take care of each other. For Thursday, July 12th, 2012, this has been the Counter-Racist Evolving Engineer Program, signing out.